I've been telling you stories about the Baal Shem Tov. So I'll tell you some more stories about the Baal Shem Tov. Come on. In continuation to the stories that I told you until now. First of all, the story how the Baal Shem Tov met the hidden tzaddikim. I explained to you that the Heilige Baal Shem Tov was terribly uncomfortable where he was. His parents were nostalgic, his parents passed away. The Baal Shem Tov's neshama was unusually sensitive. And he loved people, but he couldn't stand Lashon Hara and Rechilos and holding grudges. You know, all the things that, of course, we can't stand when other people do them to us. And we therefore, of course, to other people, right? You know. But the Baal Shem Tov was, this was reality to him, you know. And it was very difficult. But then when there would be big politics in the city, he would just disappear. He'd show up 3 days later, 4 days later, so. In any case, he once took a walk. And he went to a place which he did not normally go to. In other words, he went deeper into the forest or to an area of the forest. You know, in the old country in Europe, there was lots of forest. There was no shortage of forest. And he heard noises. Now, if I was in the forest and I heard noises, I'd go the other way. The Baal Shem Tov was afraid of nothing except for the Eibishter. So he went to the noise. As he got closer to the noise, he heard that someone's davening. But he'd never heard anybody daven like this, because this was a davening with Hishtapchus HaNefesh. It was a davening with the whole neshama of Mizok. And it was a tzaddik nistit who was out in the forest, who was davening for the Mebishn. And of course, the whole idea was that nobody would know. Baal Shem Tov crept pretty close to this yid, and he hid behind a tree, it's a Baal Tnit Rabboim, and he listened. The davening took a considerable amount of time. Let's say, for the sake of argument, that the davening took a couple of hours. He listened to his davening. And when he had finished davening, still with his talis and tefillin, he sat down on a rock and took out a gemara and he learned for a mesh asman for a period of time. And after he learned for a period of time, he closed the gemara, took off his talis and tefillin, put them away. And out of his multi-purpose sack, he took out a little bag or a little paper, and he had mamish hartebreit, old hard bread. There was a stream nearby where he had toivled before davening. He went down to the stream, took a little water, he washed his hands, he ate bread. He finished eating, he drank water, and he benched. After he finished eating, he took whatever was left over from his great meal, he packaged it back up. He put it back into his sack, and he girdled his waist, he threw the sack over his shoulder, he took his walking stick, and he's going. At that moment, the Heilige Baal Shem Tov comes out from his hiding place, and he approaches this stranger. He tells him, Shalom Aleichem, Rabid. Naturally, the man was startled. And his first instinct was that somebody had followed him from the town. And that he had been discovered. He'd been found out. So he was like very taken aback. And then he sees it's a boy. He says, Yingele. He says, you're not afraid to be out in the forest alone? He's like, no, I'm not afraid. Why aren't you afraid? My father told me before he passed away I shouldn't be afraid of anybody except for the Eibishter himself. Okay, so he got his attention. So he says to him, why do you come out into the forest? He says, I don't like the city. Because I don't like the people. I like the people, but I don't like the way they behave. Because I cannot stand Rechilus and Lashon Hara and Kine and Sine and Tachris and Netire. You know, one of the worst midas is to hold on to a grudge, to hold on to negative emotions. Some people do it some at a time, of course, never us. We don't do it every. You know, netire is alav, leisite. Leisite means don't hold a grudge. Holding a grudge means I have a negative emotion in my heart and I don't act on it. Simply having negative emotion, besides the fact that it's not good for the engine, it burns out the engine sooner. It's you know, but we're small people. And to the Baal Shem Tov, these things were abhorrent. And he's as a little child. So he says to this tzaddik nista that there are issues that are kenished. It's difficult for him. So the tzaddik nista says to the Baal Shem Tov, from which city are you? So he tells him he comes from Tlust. I told you, the son was born in Tlust. And although sometimes he writes that he came from the city of Akkub, Akkub actually meant a trench. In Tlus, they had a moat around the city as a first line of defense. And the Baal Shem Tov's parents couldn't afford to build a normal home, so they lived in this trench. So he was born literally in a hole in the ground, Bepashtus. And that's why he signs his name, sometimes Yisrael Baal Shem, from Akupi. He was born in Tlust. And he asks him about his family, he tells him his parents passed away. He says, what was your father's name? My father's name was Ebeliezer. And the Tzadik Nista said, I knew your father. And he says, would you like to learn something? Of course. Took out a Gemara Pesachim. They learned for a little bit. And obviously this Tzadik Nista realized that the Baal Shem Tov was not just an ordinary orphan, but that in fact he had inherited the holy genes. So he says to the Baal Shem Tov like this, if you wish, you can go back to your town. But I'm begging you, you should not repeat to anybody what you saw and that you met me and so on, because it's very important for my work that I remain hidden. But if you wish, you can come with me. What I will eat, you will eat. Where I will sleep, you will sleep. And, you know, like Ruth said, Elekayach Elekoi, right? Ve'amech Ami, your God is my God and your nation is my nation. And when we are amongst people, we have to act silly and simple. But when we're alone, I'll teach you Torah. Baal Shem Tov was so excited by the prospect of starting a new life. You know, he said, where do I sign? And he went with his Tzadik Nista. This Tzadik Nista, that's a Gevalgit, he was a mover. He was constantly on the move, going from place to place, doing different things. I don't know what he was up to. Doesn't say. And the Baal Shem Tov, that's a Fatem Gevalgit. For 6 months, the Baal Shem Tov went wherever he went. And like I said, he ate where he ate and slept where he slept. Nobody ever ate very, very, very well, but they survived. And when they were alone, he taught them Torah. And for the Baal Shem Tov, this is a new world. And what the Baal Shem Tov learned as he was traveling with this Tzadik Nistar is that Tzadikim Nistarim are not just isolated individual holy men, but that there's in fact a network. There's a whole union of Tzadikim Nistarim that know about one another, and they're communicating with one another, and that they have a leader. They have a center who actually gives them some kind of a order, some kind of a cohesion. And the leader's name is Rebbe Adam Baal Shem. For those who are not familiar, there were four Baal Shem. The first was Rebbe Yoel Baal Shem, who was a Talmud of Dari Zal, according to the Fiyadik Rebbe in his memoirs. He was succeeded by Rebbe Yael Baal Shem, who was succeeded by Rebbe Adam Baal Shem, who was succeeded by Rebbe Yisrael Baal Shem Tov. And that these Tzadikim Nistarim do missions for Klal Yisrael, and that the issue that they're most involved with is the issue of Pidyon Shvuyim, redeeming people who have been captured. There were many, many Jews who couldn't pay their rent, who couldn't pay their taxes, whatever it was. And the Tzadikim Nistarim had undertaken to help Yidden. And they were constantly raising money and transporting money and delivering money. It was a whole big thing how the Tzadikim Nistarim helped Klal Yisrael. After 6 months, this Tzadik Nistar brought the Baal Shem Tov to a home of an oven maker. Oven making was the perfect Tzadik Nistar profession, because oven makers needed clay, which meant you couldn't live in the middle of a city where there were, quote, paved roads, end quote. You had to live where there was plenty of quagmire, plenty of muck, plenty of mud. So oven makers would build themselves a home at the periphery of the town. There was nobody nearby. And there was, Baruch Hashem, plenty of mud. He would load up a wagon load of mud. He would schlep it into town. And he'd make out of it an old-fashioned oven. You know, an oven made out of mortar, made out of whatever it was. So this oven maker, because of his profession, his logistics, allowed him to operate at the Tzadik Nistar with relative ease and relative freedom. So his home became a strong house. It became a center. People would come and go all the time. Every day there were new faces coming and going. People were bringing messages. People were delivering messages. People were bringing money. People were picking money up. And the Baal Shem Tov was dropped off, was deposited by this oven maker. And he raised them. Again, I don't know from what age. I suspect it was earlier. It says in one place for 4 years. I mean, from the time the Baal Shem Tov was 9 till 13. But it could have been earlier too. The Baal Shem Tov lived in the home of this oven maker. And he taught him Torah. And now the Baal Shem Tov was really in his own element. He was with really, really, really holy people. Tzadikim. Naturally, their knowledge of Torah was extraordinary, and the knowledge of Seder, of Kabbalah, and so on. And the Baal Shem Tov was brought into this world. But he was told that a member of the movement he cannot be till Bar Mitzvah. They had a policy that under Bar Mitzvah didn't take you into the movement. So the Baal Shem Tov was itching to get involved and to do something. But until Bar Mitzvah, they did not permit him to. And after his Bar Mitzvah, the Baal Shem Tov joined the movement. As soon as Baal Shem Tov became a member, he became very useful. He was a young kid. And young kids can deliver messages and can carry things and go to places that an adult couldn't go because of disclosure, because it would reveal your identity. Who's going to think a 13-year-old boy is a tzaddik? And at that tender age, the Baal Shem Tov came up with a plan, which the tzaddikim nistadim implemented to a great measure of success. And because of the effectiveness of the Baal Shem Tov's plan, the Baal Shem Tov was made a leader within the movement of the tzaddikim nistadim. In the Baal Shem Tov's 14th year, Tav Ayin Beis, 1712, which the Fidiki Rebbe says is a remez, Tovei Allah Bracha, a year that brings blessing. Shem Tov was 14. He was born in Shnas Nachas. This is 14 years later. The Baal Shem Tov suggested something to the tzaddikim nistadim, which they in fact did, and did it tremendously successfully, that changed the whole nature of the function and the effectiveness and the influence of tzaddikim nistadim. But in order for me to tell you what this is, I have to go backwards. A little history. Jewish people had once upon a time lived in Western Europe. Right? They lived in Germany, they lived in France, they lived in Spain, they lived in England. And they had parnasa, and they had tzaddis. The Rebbe once asked the Rav by a Fabrengen where he was from. So he told the Rebbe that he's from Germany. And then the Rebbe sighed and he said, "Von Deutschland megahat asach teire, un asach tzaddis." The Rebbe said, "We from Germany, we had lots of teire and lots of tzaddis, never Deutschland." And Yidden lived in Western Europe. Slowly but surely, they kicked us out, right? Who were the first ones to kick the Jews out? Who knows history? Who were the first Goyim to kick the Jews out of their country? Nobody knows. Huh? The British. Who were the last Goyim to kick the Jews out of their country? The last ones. Anybody? The Spanish. Everybody knows about the expulsion. They were the last. The British kicked out the Jews 200 years before the Spanish. And the French, as is their tradition, they couldn't make up their mind. Between 1307 and 1391, they kicked them out like six or seven times and let them back in. And then finally, in 1391, they kicked them out for good. I don't know how long for good was, but it was terrible. So the Jews moved east. They moved to Poland. Poland then was not Poland today. Poland then was huge. Huge, huge. It went from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea. From the north to the south. It encompassed parts of Germany, parts of Russia, naturally Poland itself, and the Ukraine. It was gigantic. Polsha, a massive, massive country that was really a loosely unified conglomerate of what they called in those days city-states. That means to say that they were these local pritzim, these landowners, these squires who were very, very wealthy. And their claim to fame was they knew how to drink lots of wine and go and hunt and kill lots of animals. And besides that, they were mamish illiterate brutes, behemoths. Each one of these Polish landowners had a standing army, a private militia, and his citizens were abused terribly, terribly abused. Poland had a king. The king didn't have any power at all. The king was one of these landowners. Why did they need a king? That in case there would be invasion from the outside, so they needed somebody to mobilize all of these private standing armies into a unified force. That's what they had a king for. And there's a famous story that once a Jew was a king in Poland for a day. There's a Hebrew Mises. Nobody wanted the job. All he got from was headaches. I mean, there was no reward in being a king of Poland. It was just punishment. If to be a war, you had to be the one to mobilize. The Jewish people lived in Poland were caught between a rock and a hard place. In other words, between the nobility and the underclass, the peasantry. The nobility was, 1 or 2% of the population. The underclass was 97%, and they were very, very suppressed and depressed. They couldn't own their land. Everybody's land belonged to the government. And there were all these levies and these taxes that were sometimes absolutely ridiculous because these landowners needed the geld for their parties and for their hunts and for their... They lived a life of absolute narcissism and indulgence, and they had to bankroll the government. And the government was doing nothing except taking more and more taxes. These Polish goyim, how did they get rich? How could dumb people get rich? They had a natural resource which was worth more than its weight in gold. They had salt. The gigantic salt mine. I once saw a study done that in these salt mines they built underneath the ground these huge, huge, huge like cathedrals, beautiful pillars and statues. And this is, you're talking about 500 years ago. And they're corroding. They're trying to find a way to preserve these images in salt because they had these gigantic salt mines. So when they would dig out the salt, they would build these crevasses, these huge rooms, and they decorated them. You know, they painted them and beautiful and so on. I once saw pictures of it, and they were trying to find a way to preserve. It's I don't know how it's possible to do. But salt. And salt was a preservative. Salt allowed you to keep meat and to keep fish and to keep other things over the course of the winter and for extended periods of time. And salt was worth more than its weight in gold. And if you had salt, you had, essentially, you had a monopoly on refrigeration. You had a monopoly on preservation. So we're very, very wealthy. The bad news was that you don't have to be particularly smart to harvest salt, especially since you weren't even harvesting it. You had some guy do it for you. So every dumb brute, every one of these behemoths, these bullies with their salt mines, needed somebody who could think. So they all had a mushke. The generic name for a Jew in Poland was mushke. Every Jew was mushke. And the mushkes were essentially the brains behind the government. They ran the books for them. They managed their estate. They kept track of their income and their expenditures. And they looked after all of their needs. And of course, they were the ones who were the stick that actually went to collect the taxes. The Jews had to go to these goyim and say, give taxes. Now, it wasn't, the Jew was profiting nil. He was impoverished himself. But this was how he made a living. What was worse was that there was a phenomenon essentially called loan sharking. Yeah, the goyim were religious, right? They were Catholics. So Catholics considered themselves Jews. And one of the things that they did not do was borrow and lend money to and from another Catholic with interest. Because it's against the Torah, right? But the Torah says, La'noch nisashik. A Gentile, you're allowed to lend and borrow with interest. Who were the Nochrim? Who were the Gentiles? The Jews. So every Polish landowner who wanted to make profit would use a Jew as his banker. The money belonged to the Poles. The profit was earned by the potters, and the Jew was the stick. So everybody hated the Jews. Allah. The landowners hated the Jews, you know, because the Jew would sometimes come to him and say, you just drank yourself out of your last nickel. And when the guy would be informed they had no more money left, what do you do to the hand that tells you you have no more money? You beat him up. What do you mean I have no money? Bang, 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 bang. Okay, you have money. This was life for the Jews in Poland. And that Amor writes that that life was better than all the comforts they had in Western Europe. In other words, as bad as it was, there was a certain stability, a certain predictability. For hundreds of years, Jewish people lived well in Poland. Until it plopped, it blew up, it absolutely erupted. When did this happen? It happened in the year Tov Ches, 1649, which was a little bit before Shabtai Tzvi. Shabtai Tzvi's effectiveness was based a lot on these pogroms. They saw the pogroms as Chevlei Mashiach. And what happened then was like this. There was this underclass, right? Most of the people belonged to the peasantry, to the underclass, who were abused and taxed and taxed and taxed, and they plotted. They couldn't take it anymore. So they made an uprising. Khmelnytsky lived in the Ukraine, and he got together a militia, an army of like-minded peasants, and they made an uprising, a rebellion. And they started to run through Poland from south to north, from the Ukraine where they lived, northward, upwards. And wherever they went, they wreaked havoc. They would attack these castles and these fortresses, right? Every one of these people had castles, right? When we were little kids, we envisioned a castle as being a beautiful home. People lived in castles not because they're beautiful. People lived in castles because they're fortified with these thick stone walls and all of these turrets, these porches where you can shoot from, and the goyim would lock the priests would lock them up in their castles and fight off this army of brutes, of Cossacks, of troublemakers. So they couldn't kill the local potus because he was too well fortified. Who'd they pick on? The helpless Jews. And there was an unimaginable pogrom, a Holocaust, all over southern Poland. These are the famous pogroms of Tach V'Tat, 1640, 1649. I heard from a geneticist, from a medical doctor who's a geneticist, that after Khmelnytsky, the entire Ashkenazic population of Jews was reduced to 50,000 people. 50,000 left. Hastas Azay, the reason we have all these Ashkenazic diseases, you know, the reason we have these genetic diseases, especially the recessive types, is because we're all inbred. There were so few Yidden that everybody married everybody. We're all very closely related. The entire Ashkenazic Jewish population reduced to 50,000. He killed, in percentages, more than Hitler. In numbers, he killed less, but in percentages, he killed more than Hitler. It was a terrible, terrible calamity. One of the reasons this pogrom was so effective was because Jews in Poland did not live in cities. I don't know if Poland had cities. They lived very, very spread out. Because the only way to make a living was to do the kind of work that did not allow cohesion. They were farmers, they were kretschmer, they had roadside inns, they were milliners, they had water mills and forests for harvesting trees and fisheries and so on. So they lived very spread out. Most Jews in Poland davened alone, they didn't have a minyan. Shani Yom Kippur, they tried to get together a minyan, which is why it says that Amar, who lived in Poland, was the one who wrote all the halachas about what you're supposed to do when you don't daven with a minyan, because in Poland, the average Jew daven with a minyan 3 days a year. The 2 days are Shani Yom Kippur. So when the Cossacks came through, the Jews were helpless. They were tough people. You know, they weren't white-collar. They were blacksmiths. They were tough Jews, but you can't fight the whole world. So after the pogroms settled, the Jewish people that were left gathered in big cities in the hope of being able to protect themselves. Now, I just want to mention to you that it says in Svarim, the Friedrich Eber brings it down, the pshat in dem veisich nisht. I don't understand the significance of it, but I'm going to share it with you. In other words, I'm going to tell you a statement, don't ask too many questions. That in the year Tav Ches, the Shalah HaKadosh was printed the first time by Asius Menobois. The Shalah wrote a book, which is published, that was really essentially a will that he wrote for his children. And it was printed in Asius Menobois, in the same letters which they write, print a Sefer Teda, in a Chumash, and another rather than Rashi Asius. And evidently, Lamaila just created a kitrug because you're not supposed to print Tej Ba'apeh Bechlau, and certainly not Asius Menobois. So the Friedrich Rebbe says the second time the Shalah Kaddish was printed was Asius Menobois was exactly 50 years later, Shnas Nachas, 1698. But that year, nothing happened because that was the year that the Helik of Hashem Tov was born. So after these pogroms, the Jews scattered. They dispersed. I'm sorry. The Jews came together in large cities, and they couldn't make a living. What was the first thing that happens when you can't make a living? What's the first thing that happens to the community? You can't make a living. Education goes south. Little kids were trying to make ends meet, trying to find a piece of bread. So you had this poverty multiplied by disenchantment, by demoralization, by a very low sense of self, compounded by ignorance. So the Yidden in Poland am gelitten gefährliche Zeit. They were suppressed materially and spiritually. Then of course you had the Magidim, the preachers who made a living from traveling from city to city and telling people how terrible they were and getting paid for it. The preachers came from the north. They came from Lite, white Russia and Lithuania, where Khmelnytsky had not reached. The story of Bogdan Khmelnytsky was that the king finally got out of his drunken stupor, and he mobilized the armies, and they fought Khmelnytsky off, they captured Khmelnytsky, and he was put away to exile on an island where he died. So the pogrom was actually quelched, and Poland was never the same after that. After that, Poland began to fall apart, and 100-something years later, Poland disappeared off the face of the earth, not to reappear until after World War I. Poland, for 700 years, was part of Galicia, part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And in the north, in Lite, the pogrom never reached. So the Yidden in Lite were still free to study Torah and do mitzvahs with the full enthusiasm and so on. So when these magidim, these preachers, would travel south from where they lived, they would come to these Pashat Yidden, who would pay them for their speeches, and they would tell them how terrible they are, and how they're going to go to Gehenna, and the reason they're so poor is because they don't respect Torah, and all this kind of nonsense. They were so, may have been true, but totally irrelevant. It wasn't true for them. And the Jews would sit and cry. And they'd make these heartfelt speeches. And when one of these magidim would go into a frenzy, you know, he'd lose it, he'd absolutely go hysterical. Such a shrine that if you Jews don't start respecting Torah and studying Torah, the Eibush is going to send Chmelnitsky again. And when you said this, it's like saying you're going to send Achmanos on you know who. Yidden would push to have heart attacks. People would, it was terrible. And problems like these only get worse. They don't get better. You have to understand, one of the silver linings to the cloud of the Holocaust was that about 95% of the Jews who survived moved away from the homes and from the cities where the blood was soaking into the ground. You understand, most of us left Europe. In Poland, they stayed right there. Same city, same community, same shuls. They could point at a spot. You understand? It gave us, when we came to America, it gave us a new opportunity because we could dissociate from the old life. They couldn't do that. And when the Baal Shem Tov was born, he was born into the third generation of this entrenchment of poverty, of demoralization, of ignorance, and being banged on the head and saying thank you. The tzaddik and the stadim were concerned. Obviously, they wanted to fix it. They couldn't find a solution. They were spending their days and their nights taking people out of jail. Wherever you look, a Jew owed money, couldn't pay, he went to jail. But you know what jail was? It was a hole in the ground. They put you in and your wife in and your children in, and then you waste how it was. And the tzaddik and the stadim were in an intransigent situation. They were stuck in a rut. They were going around and around in a circle. And they could find no resolution. Along came the 13-year-old Baal Shem Tov with a proposal. And the proposal was very simple. Give Yidden jobs. Simple. They don't need now Yiddishkeit, they don't hear about the Eibishter, they still don't need to how terrible they are. Parnas. And the Baal Shem Tov's proposal was several parts to the plan. And it took about a quarter century, about 25 years, a generation or so, to implement this plan. And the Baal Shem Tov personally oversaw the effort in bringing the Jews of Greater Poland, which was a good number of Ashkenazic Jewry, back to the living in all intents and purposes. And the first step in the plan was to push to give Yidden Pandas. How do you do that? So the Baal Shem Tov proposed that each one of the Zikim and the Stadim should take seed money, take money, go to a different place, find Jews and convince them that they should move away from the big cities where they were gathered. The Jews would not hear of it because they felt that staying together was the gear for survival. You know, they'd rather be hungry than dead. And the Tzaddik and the Stadim would console them and say, don't you worry, he's dead and he's buried and he's rotted and he's not coming back and maybe she's going to protect you. Don't be afraid. Go and reestablish your life. They went around, they went place to place. Wherever they went, they found Yidden. And wherever they found Yidden, they would encourage them to move back to the villages, into the fields, into the forests, into the fisheries, into the mills, and to the kretchmas. Jewish people made a living, you know, moonshining, making mashke, and kretchmen, and having inns, and batei mazeach, and taverns. I mean, it's a funny thing to think that Jews made a living selling booze. Made a living in bars. But that's how you made a living. They had no choice. And the Jews, of course, didn't listen. A Tzad Nista shows up in town and says, you have to move. Everyone says, he's crazy. Self-preservation, life. And he would tell them, Chmelnitsky's gone, Chmelnitsky's dead, he's not coming back, and so forth. And most of the Jews refused to hear it. Refused. But once in a while, they found the Yid who had courage. And he would say, if I move, how can I start a business? They have no money. He said, oh, Geld haben wir, we have seed money. And they would loan them money. The Jew would establish himself, they take the money back and reuse it. And slowly but surely, they were the first mavericks, and eventually Jewish people started to listen, and they moved back away from the big cities back to the villages, and Yidden had parnasa. And now that Yidden had parnasa, the tzaddik and the stanim went around for a second round. And this time, they went around to become alamdim. Mr. You show up in shul one morning, a Jew is sleeping on a bench, you ask him a name, he tells his name is Koppel, and he's around, and he meets the people, and he finds out how ignorant they are. And he starts to teach everybody, men, women, and children. First alabes, and little chumash, and little mishnayas, and he slowly but surely the whole town gravitates there. These tzaddikim that started were obviously wonderful Jews, special Jews, very, very fair. And people used to come to them for mishpat. Whenever they had conflicts, they would go to them. Even the goyim lahavda. The goyim, whenever they had a conflict with a Jew, they would go to this tzaddik nister, because they knew one thing, that the tzaddik nister is above a lie. And this is how it was. Tzaddikim that started lived in town, and people gravitated to them. But one fine day, the people wake up in the morning, and the tzaddik nista had disappeared, finished, disappeared. Of course, they went looking for him. It was like God died. It was the worst thing in the world. It should not have been spoken. It was the worst thing. So they mourned. They looked for him, they couldn't find him. Where did he go? He traveled the distance, and repeated the same performance a second time. Say, 6-7 months. Woke people up and vanished. Went to the next town. So after the Jews got over the fact that the tzaddik nista is gone, they did the next best thing. They sent an emissary to Litta and they hired a malamed. Because what he did was he created an appetite for Torah. And slowly people started to send their children north where there was yeshivas to learn. And over the course of a generation, people started to, their children started coming home from yeshivas and they had Torah. Young Elijah could afford it, would hire, would buy. It's a bad word, buy, but that's the right word. Son-in-laws who were b'nei Torah were talmid chachamim to marry their daughters. And over the course of that period of time, Yiddishkeit and Torah specifically was brought back to Pale, and it was rejuvenated. And this is why the Baal Shem Tov was appointed a leader in the movement of Tzaddikim Nistarim, because this unbelievably effective plan. And the Rebbe used to always say that the message here is that the Esh Tzach Mivelech Chassidus Vanemtzach, the first thing that's the issue of Chassidus, is Gav Ma Yidin Panosa Bagashmas. Before you give a Jew Ruch Yizdika Panosa, you give Panosa Bagashmas. The Magidim, the preachers, nobody told them that there's holy Jews wandering around. They came around to make their speeches. Every once in a while, a maggid would run headlong into a tzaddik nista. He'd get up to make his speech and tell the Jews how terrible they are, how much they're going to suffer because they don't love Torah and they're going to make the chachamim. And all of a sudden, this one-eyed cripple would say, Erebe, I think it says in the Gemara, Afapi shechata Yisraelu. Even if a Jew sins, he's still a Jew and the Eibishter loves him. Right, and so on and so forth. And that they call him Shabbach, Malay Mitzvah Kerimin. The emptiest Jew is filled with mitzvahs like a pomegranate is filled with seeds. And, so, and the tzaddikim, these magidim would argue, and then eventually they realized that they were stumped. The people would hear. It is another way of looking at them, and that in fact, the Eibishter likes them, and they're wonderful Jews. They would be so excited, they would push it up and applaud. This was the basic plan that Baal Shem Tov had, that before you can help Yidden, Beruch is a Talmidin Bagashmas. Okay? The Baal Shem Tov himself practiced this, and there are Ribui Sipurim, there's many stories about how the Baal Shem Tov himself behaved when he was a Tzaddik Nister. But we're going to leave that. That's enough. Okay, we spent half an hour telling stories. And now we're going to look.